This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. By now, we've all heard the scientific explanation for the earthquake that triggered the Indian Ocean tsunami, the subduction of the Indian plate beneath the Burma plate. But for the survivors, victims, and even distant observers, many questions remain, questions that geologists and other experts will never be able to answer. Why did this happen to me, to my family, to my neighborhood, my business? Why did I survive when so many others died? Through history, many turned to their god or gods after such events. Why did they fail to protect us? Was this divine retribution? At the same time we take solace in faith, we wonder how a compassionate God could allow such terrible destruction. The questions are being asked most urgently in the Indian Ocean region. Most of those killed on that Sunday were in Indonesia and were Muslim, but the tsunami also tore through the lives of Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, atheists. How do these different religions explain such tragedy? What do the followers of these faiths think in the aftermath? Later in the program, we'll look at how many religions and customs and science came together to create our modern calendar. But first, acts of God. Does disaster challenge your religious beliefs or reinforce them? If you're a preacher of whatever faith, what are you telling your congregation? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. This is not the first cataclysm to occur in this part of the world. In 1883, the volcanic island of Krakatoa exploded in a massive eruption off the coast of Java. Joining us now is Simon Winchester, the author of Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded. He sees some parallels between that disaster and what happened the day after Christmas, and he's with us now by phone from his hotel in London. Simon, good to talk with you again.
Hello.
How did people living in the then Dutch East Indies explain this massive eruption?
Well, it was very interesting. Hitherto, most of the Sumatrans and the Javans, and the volcano happened almost equidistant between those two islands, had been Hindus. And I think generally, you'll hear probably later in the program, that most Hindus have a general acceptance of these terrible acts. They don't see a vengeful God. They think that if they behave properly as a reaction to the events, then they will have a better chance of a better life next time around. But in 1883, there was a massive program of conversion going along, spearheaded by mullahs from Arabia who were trying to convert the Hindus to Islam, and they were doing incredibly well. And the leader of the movement was a Haji from the Hadramaut, the very southern part of Arabian Peninsula, called Abdul Karim. And a few days after the dust quite literally had settled after Krakatoa, he gathered his fellow mullahs together and said that this was clearly a sign from Allah, a sign of enormous displeasure at the situation that obtained in Java and Sumatra, and specifically displeasure that the Javanese and the Sumatrans were allowing themselves to be ruled by white Western imperialist Dutchmen. So he said, rise up and kill them. And this did indeed trigger almost immediately a small rebellion against the Dutch. It was quickly put down. And Abdul Karim gathered his priests together again and said, no, don't go about this in a piecemeal fashion. Go about it in an organized way. And slowly and carefully, they built up a rebellion based on religious grounds against the Dutch, and 5 years later it broke out. Many, many people were killed on both sides, and it was really the beginning of the end of Dutch rule and the beginning of the creation of the state of Indonesia.
Interesting. You make a point in your book about Krakatoa that in 1883 we were in a technological era. The news of this was on the newspapers in Boston within hours, yet there was no scientific explanation for what had happened. That's different now.
Well, I think that was a situation that obtained until the middle of the last century, and by that I mean the 20th century, because communication permitted the news of these enormous catastrophes to be spread around the world very, very quickly, and Krakatoa was the first one, as you rightly say, within a matter of hours, whereas it had taken more than a week for the news of Lincoln's assassination, for instance, to get to London. And yet people didn't have the explanation of these events to add to the information of it's happening. And so they were bewildered. They were puzzled. They knew something terrible had happened on the far side of the world. But as to why it had happened, they had no explanation at all. And so inevitably, and this wasn't only in 1883 in Krakatoa, inevitably they turned to God as an explanation, an angry God. And so looking to the skies became, really until the 1950s, an explanation for all these major, major seismic events.
Mm-hmm. And what are we hearing this time around about people's reactions to this tsunami?
Well, very similar. In Banda Aceh, the mullahs are saying, this is a sign from Allah. He's a sign that he's angry. But he's angry not because the Banda Aceh people are being ruled by the Dutch. They're not. They haven't since the 1950s. They're being bad Muslims. They are doing things like, having premarital sex or lending money at usurious rates or drinking and smoking and doing things that good Muslims should not do. And so this is a signal from God that mankind better clean up his act and Islam must be enforced in a more fundamental way than it has been in the past. So much the same things happened, but with a rather different target for Allah's annoyance.
Throughout history, there have been other disasters that have had impacts on religion and vice versa. 1755, I think it was, in Lisbon, in Portugal, many questioned why such destruction would be visited upon entirely innocent people. I know you're writing a book now about the San Francisco earthquake in 1906.
Yes, and oddly enough, much the same thing I came across. In 1906, just a few days before the earthquake which leveled the city on the Wednesday, the 18th of April in that year, just on the Sunday, just before that, in a place called Azusa Street in Los Angeles, there was a very small meeting of an extremely flamboyant Christian movement, which was known essentially as the Pentecostalist movement, with a lot of arm-waving pastors, with a lot of speaking in tongues and much sort of Christian drama. Not many people attended, but the pastor said, believe you me, there will be a sign from God. That was Sunday. Come Wednesday, San Francisco was leveled. He said, aha, there's the sign from God that he's annoyed with the licentiousness of life up in San Francisco. The next week, thousands attended the service, and the Pentecostalist movement, which is still tremendously important in America today, essentially was born as a result of the San Francisco earthquake.
Let's get some callers involved in this conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Randy. Randy's calling from Jacksonville.
Hello. Hello.
Randy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, how you doing? I'd like to address – I'm just make a comment. Currently, I've been a Sunday school teacher at our local church here in Jacksonville, Florida, for about 13 years, and currently going to Bible college, going into the ministry. A lot of people want to look to gods and their gods, but if you read the scriptures, it simply tells us that due to the nature of what sin has caused in the world with mankind is the fact that the earth is in a travail, an occurrence constantly correcting itself, kind of like groaning as if a woman is going into labor. And to look to the scriptures would be a more easier way of explaining what we have been seeing and what we're going to see in the future. A lot more. So I just thought I'd like to make a comment on that, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, Randy, thanks for the call. So there are people who still feel that these are acts of a vengeful God.
And indeed, if you look in the Bible, as I did when I was searching for a title for my San Francisco book, I was looking at Cruden's Concordance, which is the big index to the Bible and the ways in which words appear in the Bible. The word earthquake appears dozens upon dozens of times in almost every single book of the Bible, and invariably it's mentioned in a way that signals that it is an example of the wrath of God. So earthquakes, pestilence, flood, disease, all of this, when on a massive scale, is seen biblically as a sign from heaven and from God.
Let's talk now with Frank. Frank's calling from Cleveland.
Oh, yes. First of all, let me preface my statements by saying I do not believe in a personal God. I believe that the concept of a personal God is a construct of human beings to give them solace in times of difficulties such as this, but that if this is as near to a proof as we could ask for that there is no such thing as a personal solicitous God that watches over human beings, gets angry when they do bad things and gives them rewards when they do good things.
So the scientific explanation, Frank, is for you explanation enough?
Oh, of course. I think it's the height of arrogance that people would think that they're important enough in this vast universe to warrant being watched over. The whole process was set in motion. We're on our own. If we want to construct this concept, fine. The trouble with this construct of a personal God is it leads to endless slaughters between people that believe A against people that believe B. That's my belief.
Frank, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Simon, before we let you go, your books, many of them, books about geology, the science that first raised questions about the literal interpretations of the Bible. This one, Krakatoa, of course, is no different, and San Francisco, I suspect, will be no different either. Scientific explanations and religious explanations, yours have focused on the Christian world largely in the past.
Yes, that is true, and we haven't really understood too much about what the Hindu explanation, the Buddhist explanation, the Confucian, the Shinto explanation, and it is interesting if you look at how, I mean, one has to remember in this context that the mightiest of all recent earthquakes took place in Tangshan in China, and I remember it very well, in, I think, 1979, the same year as Mao Zedong died. 250,000 people were killed by that earthquake, and of course the Communist Party associated with the death of Mao Zedong. So cultures tend to associate catastrophes with whatever is conveniently at hand, and it is sometimes God, sometimes despotic leaders, and sometimes, happily, sometimes it's science.
Simon Winchester, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Simon Winchester joined us by phone from London. His new book, A Crack in the Edge of the World, will be published come October. When we come back, we'll look at how other religions look at events like the Indian Ocean tsunami. We'll take more of your calls, of course, as well. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about acts of gods, religion, and disasters. And joining us now is Asoka Bandarage, a visiting professor of South Asian Studies at Georgetown University. And, of course, you're invited to join our conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Professor Bandarage is the author of, among other books, Women, Population, and Global Crisis, a Political Economic Analysis. And she's kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Your family is from Sri Lanka, which is, of course, in terms of the percentage of the population killed in this, among the worst sufferers in the region. Your parents still live there?
Yes, my parents live in Colombo, the capital of Sri Lanka.
Were they affected by the tsunami?
Well, they escaped very narrowly. My father is in his 80s, and he hardly ever travels out of the city anymore. But ironically, the day before the tsunami hit, he decided to go and visit his ancestral village, which is on the southern coast. And he and my mother went there and toured the area, met relatives, and had even contemplated staying over the night, on the sea, his ancestral area. And they ran into a friend, a Buddhist monk, a Japanese Buddhist monk, at a popular seaside restaurant called Moni's Bakery in Payagala, and they got into a long conversation, and it was getting late, and they decided to come back to the city. A few hours later, the tsunami tidal waves washed away all the three Moni's bakeries in Payagala. And the Buddhist monk, Venerable Asami, had gone back to Gaul, where he's building a peace pagoda overlooking the Unavatuna beach, which was devastated. And when I called, my parents were extremely worried about Reverend Asami because they couldn't get through to him. And later, we found out that he was okay, and the peace pagoda was untouched amidst all the devastation.
Many Sri Lankans are of the Buddhist faith. You are, as I understand it, yourself. How does your religion cope with such disasters? Does it try to explain them?
Well, the fundamental teaching is that all phenomena are impermanent, all material and mental phenomena. And that if we get too attached to this impermanent changing phenomena, that we suffer because of our excessive attachment and craving. And of course, rationally, you know, we can understand that. But in a situation like this, you know, where the tragedy is unfathomable and the pain almost unbearable, I think people have to resort to certain kinds of rituals and emotional and social support, mm-hmm. which they have resorted to. And the Buddhist monks in particular have taken a leading role in providing immediate relief and support. The temples have been open to refugees. Many hundreds and thousands of them are living in those temples. And what is interesting is that Buddhism is inherently a very tolerant religion, and it sees human suffering and the possibility of human liberation and happiness as universal and not as sectarian.
Yeah, but getting back to what you were saying just a moment ago, this was some kind of, again, the emotions of the moment, the awfulness, but some kind of karmic retribution?
Well, I think that karma is interpreted not as fate, you know, a God-given fate, but karma meaning action. And certainly there is cause and effect, but I think that cause and effect can be interpreted in so many different ways, given that we live in an interdependent world. So I think that there is the sense that it is all relative, that reality is relative, that we have to not simply think of past lives and future lives and, you know, cause and effect over lives, but also in this mundane physical world. And so I think that there is an attempt to understand it along those lines, including looking at, you know, the relationship between poverty and wealth. You know, why is it that it is the poor, you know, who are mostly the victims? You know, why is it that they crowded and lived on the flimsy shacks on the beaches? And what is the role of the richer communities around the world, because it is seen as a human tragedy, to help out? So I think it is the in the teaching also, generosity is really emphasized, not just meditation practice. So there's been an outpouring of support across the communities, you know, which has been really wonderful to watch.
Let's get some more listeners in the conversation. Fatima joins us from Charlotte.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I listen to your show often, and I'm very glad that this show is actually on. My point that I have today is to stress the idea that people have to understand that God is in control. Whether or not you want to believe it or you feel that it's necessary for you to believe that, we as humans have to know that there is a higher power and that we do not have the full control as we think that we do or as we want to. And basically, I would just like to say to all those victims who have passed on and all those family members who are left behind to keep praying, believe in God, and that you know that you will come through and you will rise on the top.
I'm just trying to understand a little bit more. Do you see this as a message, a warning, a test?
Well, I'm not so much a message or a warning. I see it more as a lesson that we need to understand that God is in full control. We do not have the amount of control that we think that we have. God is in control, and that whenever God decides anything that's going to happen, it will happen in that way. And we have to exercise our faith more and just believe in God that He is going to bring us through this.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the phone call. That's obviously different religions have different explanations for such things. Let's talk to some more listeners. This is Coy, and Coy is calling from Mesa, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share, as I looked through some of the pictures, I thought about not just this massive amount of people who have passed on, but there's 150-some-odd families out there who are suffering, and that's obviously who the questions that we're asking are in their mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a couple years as a missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
The Mormons, yes.
Yes, right. And I kind of spent most of my time teaching people about that these kind of things in life are a test for us. They're not necessarily not every accident or every tragedy in life is intentionally set upon us by God, but this life as a whole is set here for us to go through positive and negative experiences, which allow us to learn, to grow, and through those negative experiences, we can appreciate the positive.
So a test of sorts?
Sorry?
A test of sorts?
Yes, exactly. Like a test that would allow us to show that we gain strength by rising above the challenges and the trials in life. Not that God is angry at us all the time because something happens to us, but more that he's providing for us opportunities to rise above the challenges and rise above the negative parts of life and become strong,
mm-hmm.
and show that we can make positive from the negative. And also, just to add to that these sorts of accidents that cause death are not the end. Death isn't the end. This life is a means to an end, which is it's being the test that we have somewhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
If we do die in this life, it's a sorrowful thing for us, and it's more for the families, I believe, that are here, that are still here on the earth. But beyond that, there's people who have passed on who now have found, as I believe, have found a better place.
Coy, thank you. I appreciate the
phone
call. Asoka Bandarage, I wanted to ask you, from your Buddhist perspective, mm-hmm. do you see anything positive that could emerge from such an awful disaster?
Yes, I think that the positive is that people can begin to see the unity of the human experience, because half the bodies could not be identified, the bodies of the victims. Their religion or language couldn't be determined. And I think what was discernible is the common pain and suffering, and to see, our interconnectedness, and to try to see beyond, the sectarian divisions. And also see that life is always in a process of being. In Buddhism, there is no belief in a creator or God, but that everything is always in a process of becoming something else. And to understand that reality, but there is also the possibility of human agency, of human action. And I think that is also what we are beginning to see, that sense of generosity and compassion throughout the world. So in a sense, there is a tremendous lesson here for us to come together, to rise beyond our differences. Again, also a lesson in humility, whether one believes in a God or not, that we don't always control everything, but we can, control our consciousness and our actions.
Asoka Bandarage, thank you very much for being with us. Joined us here in Studio 3A. She's a visiting professor of South Asian Studies at Georgetown University, and among her books is Colonialism in Sri Lanka, The Political Economy of the Kandyan Islands. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Appreciate it. Joining us now is the Reverend David O'Leary, a Roman Catholic priest and chaplain at Tufts University. He's with us by phone from his office at Tufts. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon, Neil.
The Christian God is supposed to be one of mercy and compassion. How does your faith explain the loss of so many innocent lives?
Well, this is the question that David Hume put. If God is God willing to prevent evil and not able? And so I would say a Christian perspective would be that there's an active will of God and a passive will of God. And passively, God's will is to allow creation to be, and so natural disasters happen. I would not say that any natural disaster is punishment from God by any means. I would not say that's the mainline Christian view at all.
Mm-hmm. Let me pose this email to you. This is from Marshall Scott in Kansas City, Missouri. He's a chaplain in healthcare. He works with this question daily. He writes, in more than 20 years in practice, I've never found a completely satisfactory answer. However, I think regularly of two things. First, reflecting a basis in process theology, I believe God cannot micromanage everything without removing our humanity, which must include free will. Reflecting Paul's comments in Philippians, I take comfort in the thought that in becoming incarnate, Christ emptied himself so as to become truly human and thus really experience humanity. Finally, I take a sense of responsibility from the words of Jesus in John regarding the man born blind. This is not an issue of who sinned, but an opportunity to see God's mercy in contemporary terms by Christians demonstrating compassionate love.
Right. I would agree with that. We cannot be puppets on strings. God has given us free will. I mean, if we're going to reduce all of the world to this concept of a creator controlling everything, then what happens to our free will?
I know you're a student of other religions as well. Obviously, many of them see this differently.
Yo, very much so. But I would say most of the monotheistic faith groups would have a very similar outlook, that the opportunity is now how do we use our freedom to help people. And we help not because they're Islamic, we help not because they're of a particular nationality, but we help because they're in need.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this
sure.
is Imam Zed Malik, who's calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hello?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yes, this is Imam Zed. The Islamic perspective on the disasters like this, we believe that there are tests from God the Almighty and there are punishments from him. And those who are tested by God, they are the ones who are beloved of God. And those who are punished, they are the ones who deserve punishment. And there is a saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him also. He says that, he said about these sudden deaths, that there are several kinds of being martyr. And one of the kinds of having martyrdom, he said, is that being drowned or dying under the roof, if the roof falls, which is we see in the cases of earthquakes. And we believe that the Muslims, the believers who die this way, sudden death, they are martyrs. And they will be rewarded, and there could be some among them who, in their case, it could be a punishment also, because of our sins.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is that if a test is coming to us, if we are tested, are we patient, or how do we respond to God the Almighty?
We're talking about disasters and religion. You're listening to Talk of the Nation
yeah.
from NPR News.
Okay.
And Imam, and I'd like to bring Father O'Leary into this as well. The children, clearly innocent people, would they be among the martyrs in this explanation?
Yes, actually, you reminded me of another thing of Prophet Muhammad, that he was asked about the infants who die, what would be their destiny, and he said that they will go to the heaven, they will go to the paradise, because they never committed any sin, because the sin starts when we reach the puberty. At that time, the sin is really counted. So we personally believe that this is a test from God the Almighty, although we do not deny the scientific realities, the scientific reasons behind these earthquakes and then consequently the tsunami.
But that would be the mechanism of God's will.
Yes, we believe that the real causer of all these things is God the Almighty himself.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I would say the more... A different way to look at it would be the problem of evil that many philosophers and theologians have looked at. And we have to separate personal evil from natural evil. And so I would never say that a natural disaster is a manifestation on anyone's goodness or badness in the eyes of a creator God. Natural things happen, and some things are very tragic.
Okay. Imam Zed Malik, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Reverend O'Leary, well, we don't have enough time left in this segment, so hang with us, and we'll continue this conversation after we return from a short break. We're talking with the Reverend David O'Leary, chaplain at Tufts University, and we'll take more of your calls and emails on the question of God and religion and disasters. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll also be talking with Michael Judge, the author of a new book, The Dance of Time, The Origins of the Calendar. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about God and disasters. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. Our guest is the Reverend David O'Leary, chaplain at Tufts University, a professor of comparative religion there. And let's get another listener on the line, and this is Mendel. Mendel's calling from Baltimore.
Yes, Neil.
Hi.
Hi. There's several explanations for what's going on in Jewish thinking, first of which is that, to amplify what a caller mentioned before, a woman going into labor, and in Jewish thinking it's called Chevlei HaMashiach, the birth pangs of the Messiah. And what the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Melech HaMashiach, told us starting in 1991 when the Gulf War happened was that was the beginning of the revelation of the Messiah. When he quoted the Yalkut Shmoni, which is a classic text of prophecy in Jewish thought, which said that when the king of Paras being Iraq, modern-day Iraq, fights with the king of Aram, fights with the king, it turned out to be Kuwait, and then Aram, the United States, gets into it, the whole world will be tittering. They'll be
so all of this is part of a biblical, prophecy. This is all accounted for.
It gets darkest before the dawn. This is the closest we've come to the sign of the that we had a great flood that because of the evil of mankind, the world was destroyed. But the rabbis are telling us that although it's true that this is right before the coming of the redemption, we need to look at our actions, repent, the Jewish people do, because no calamity comes into the world except for the sake of the Jews, which means that the Jewish actions in leading the nations of the world by setting proper examples, by being the lamplight into the nations, determines how the rest of mankind will act. And there's no kol b'dei shemayim chutz yirei shemayim. Nothing comes into this world except from a decree above. If a man cuts his finger on this world, it's because of some sin that he needs to check and to repent for and to come on the proper path because of. So Jewish thought here is as reflexive, but also joyful in the fact that that this is the beginning of the redemption of the Melech HaMashiach, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who will reveal himself more fully as time goes on any time now.
Mendel, thank you very much for the phone call.
I would think that would be more of a perspective from a Hasidic perspective and not reformed, a conservative perspective of Judaism.
Mm-hmm. There's certainly a lot of other strains of opinion.
Right, just like in Christianity, you would have some who fundamentalists would start to read in the book of Revelation and not see that interpretation of sacred texts is important.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on. This is Roger Woolsey, who's calling us from Littleton, Colorado.
Yes, I'm a Christian pastor, probably of a more liberal bent than some of the callers that have been calling in so far. I guess I would say I'm a child of the Enlightenment, and it makes me think of Voltaire's famed book, Candide, which he wrote in response to, I suppose, Leibniz's philosophy, and also Alexander Pope's Essay on Man, where there's a famed line, this is the best of all possible worlds, and whatever is right. And Voltaire made light of that in a satirical way through Candide, by pointing out all how the various earthquakes and volcanoes and wars that had been going on could not be because of some god desiring this, ordaining it from above. And really, I guess my perspective on this is that God has set up the world such that the laws of nature must, laws of physics must run their course. And if there's someone who gets hit by a boulder that falls off of a cliff, they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Likewise, on a greater scale with a tsunami or something of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's God is not decreeing these things to happen, but rather is a vital force to help us make peace and to transform life and renew it in response to these situations.
So accident, yet we can still find meaning in it.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate the phone call.
You bet.
And Father O'Leary, among your hats, as we mentioned, a professor of comparative religion.
At Tufts University, yes.
Yes. Yeah. We've not heard yet from the Hindus. How would Hindu religion interpret this event?
Well, Hindu religion has Shiva, which is the destroyer god. So Hinduism would be very comfortable with the idea of destruction and then a rebirth from destruction. Hinduism, sometimes they call it the trifold gods in Hinduism, of Brahman, Vishnu, and Shiva. Brahman being creator, Vishnu being the preserver, and Shiva being the destroyer.
Hmm.
So in Hinduism, there would be this sense of it's just all process.
What can we learn, as a professor of comparative religion, what can we learn from the different ways that various religions try to find meaning in such cataclysmic events?
Well, I think the meaning should be is not in religion or nationality, but we help those in need. I mean, from a Christian perspective, the story of the Good Samaritan was really an answer to the question, who is my neighbor? And the answer was, my neighbor is anyone in need, regardless of religion or nationality.
Reverend O'Leary, thank you very much. David O'Leary is chaplain at Tufts University and joined us by phone from his office there, and we thank him for his time today.